Welcome to Burning River Radio, where we only talk about teams that play Central Division 2 years in a row. Topic of discussion on this show. I'm Joe Koblitz, and I'm joined, as always, by a whole lot of Lotta, Justin.
Hey.
At JL underscore baseball.
Yo.
And you can follow me at Burning River BB if you'd like to.
I don't recommend it, but that's okay.
I do because I'm really funny and I have all these case stats. It's really important. Nobody else. I wanted to talk about something else, but I'll start with this. I've been keeping track of the Indians' strikeouts all year, different aspects of it. The biggest one may be Corey Kluber as an individual moving up the all-time rankings in career. And then now he's moving up the single-season rankings, and he's got a good chance he's going to finish sixth in Indians history in single-season strikeouts for just this year, and he missed a month of the season. So, like, that was incredible to me anyway. And then the season, like, there's going to be more strikeouts in baseball this year than any other year ever, probably. There's a chance it's second to last year, but it's probably going to be first. The Indians broke the American League record last week, and they never mentioned it on STO. They still haven't mentioned it. Every strikeout furthers the record that they already broke, and they've never mentioned it. It floors me. And so I keep looking at Fangraphs, like, is this right? Like, I'm saying the right things, right?
Is it possible that maybe this whole – I mean, yeah, they broke the records, but is it possible that these records aren't as big a deal because of how many strikeouts there are in the game today? Like, as a staff, it's impressive. Like,
he spent 10 minutes talking about how they were going to be the first team to average 10 per nine.
Right, I was going to say, that's the first time a team would do that.
So if you think about that, there's more games played now than have ever been played before, or the same amount as the last 30 or 40 years, but before that they played less games. It's not like they used to play 170 games and now they play 162. So there's more games played, and they're going to set a record for highest K per nine. They have to set the record for most strikeouts too, like, it fits. So it should be an obvious thing, but whatever. And they will set the major league record. This is Sunday. They are on pace to set it in 4 days. So,
and they're going to have 3 200 strikeout guys because Bauer should eventually get to 200.
Yeah. So Friday they should break the Dodgers record.
Have they ever had 3 200 strikeout guys in the same rotation in the season?
I can look that up real quick here. I don't know offhand. I do know that. Sorry, what was that?
They had Louis Tion and Sam McDowell as the
1968 was the year of the pitcher, which kind of like this year, it may get a little diminished in importance. And both of them, I guess. Yeah, Louis Tion in 68 had 264. That's actually the last time someone other than – there's two guys, Feller or Herb Score in 1956 and Louis Tion in 1968 are the only guys that aren't Feller, McDowell, got 250 ever for the Indians. 250 is Feller, McDowell, or Kluber. That's it.
And Sam McDowell is not he was not an MLB Hall of Fame, just the Indians, right?
Yeah, well, he had some issues.
Well, no kidding, really?
But but also his career, like, the problem is his career ended too early. I think it's kind of like Albert Bell, where he was hated by the media and his career ended too early. Whereas I think if he was just hated by the media, Ted Williams was hated by the media, and he's in the Hall of Fame. I mean, if you keep it going long enough,
they can't avoid you.
Get put in eventually, unless you have some steroid thing or whatever. Okay, let's see. I finally got that number if you asked. There were two guys in 1960 and 1968. Other than that, they've never even... Oh, and two guys in 2015.
So they never had three.
Three, they've only had three different times.
So they're going to have three this year, unless Bauer just really struggles.
in 67, 68, it was McDowell and Tiant both years that had 200. We're talking about not 250. So it's very the guys who have 200. Five that ever did it were Feller. Then Score did it twice. Then six times. Tiant did it twice within those McDowell years. Gaylord Perry did it all 3 years he was with the Indians. Eckersley did it once. And then you go from 1976 to 2000 before there's another one. Cologne did it twice. Sabathia, three Klubers, Nekrasko. It's just like, so I do think it's a big deal because of that. Because it's not like, and that's like when they talk about the offense being bigger now. It's funny, strikeouts are higher than ever. Offense is greater than ever at the same time. But when they talk about that, they ignore like the 1930s. The 1930s were a huge offensive boom. Like there were tons of run scores. Like records were set that were never broken. The Indians, like home run records were set in the 30s that didn't get broken until the 50s. You know, there were a lot of things that happened there. RBI record that was set in the 30s wasn't broken until Manny Ramirez broke it in 1999. So there were a lot of things that happened back then that kind of that whole decade gets thrown out, I feel.
Well, which just tells you how bad the Indians had to be between the late 50s and early 90s.
Yeah, and in 1993. They were good in 94.
Well, I mean, as I said, early 90s, so you can say
yeah,
really early 90s, yeah.
All right, so what I wanted to start on was what's bigger for you? What's more exciting? Winning 22 games in a row or clinching the Central Division at midnight because the Twins lost?
I think most people probably expected. If you didn't, there were like a few writers that were, I don't know what they were thinking when they made their predictions in Cleveland that predicted that the Indians would not win the division. So I think like 90% of people were already guessing the Indians were going to win the division. And even without the 20 streak, they were still going to win it. You'd never expect.
Well, I can tell you, I have our predictions up and our staff all picked Cleveland to win. The funny thing is everybody but Mike picked Detroit to come in second, and they're going to come in fourth, I believe.
Did everybody pick Detroit to come in second?
Everybody except Mike picked Detroit to come. And I thought they would too. I was definitely right there, and I picked KC 3 and Minnesota 4. So and almost everybody picked Minnesota 4th. Gavin had them 5th.
Well, I mean, it's hard to I think Minnesota – seeing Minnesota do what they've done is hard to predict.
Yeah, but you didn't answer my question.
Oh, it's the winning streak for sure.
Oh, it's the winning streak. Yeah, I think so too. And I wrote in I just wrote a piece on Sunday morning about the winning streak as a whole, since it was finally over. You could kind of reflect on it. And I started off saying that the Indians didn't even care if they won those doubleheaders, the doubleheaders against New York and Detroit. I feel like on each of those games, and especially when you look at what Francona's lineups were at those games, like the first game, he put everything out there. Let's win the first game of the doubleheader. The second game is like, no, let's give everybody a day off and just go out. And they ended up winning them. And I said the reason I didn't think they needed to win those games was, one, they had already won the Yankee series by the time they played that last game. They had already won both the season series and that individual series. And they were like 5 games ahead of the Twins. And to me, a team that's that good and is winning series against playoff contenders, like they split Boston, they beat New York. You know, like you're winning those series and you're that far ahead with just a month left, you don't have to win every single game. So I had kind of put the Central Division away back then. So when they clinch it with essentially 2 weeks left in the season or 12 games left in the season, it's like, who cares? Like, we knew they were going to clinch it, but to win 22 in a row is really special.
Well, I mean, they won 14 in a row last year. No one expected that. And then, of course, you have the window company who, you know, sets that special offer for if they win 15 in a row, they'll give away free windows. So clearly nobody was expecting the Indians to win 15 in a row for winning 14 in a row last year, because how much luck has to go into that?
Absolutely. And I think – and somebody said – somebody was complaining because some of the national people, some idiots, you know, that are fans of other teams got mad and jealous of the Indians or whatever. and they were saying that it was all luck. And they and this person on Twitter said, none of it's luck. And I was like, no, a lot of it is luck. Like, you need the base. If you don't have a team that can win 20 out of 30 games or, you know, 20 out of 35 games, you have to have that team that can win that many games out of a stretch, two in a row. to have that, you still have to be a good team. You can't be a team that's only going to win 60 games in a season and win 22 games in a row.
Well, I mean, think about it. Like, you know, everyone's stupid point last year about how, well, if you take away the 14-game winning streak, they're just an average team. But that assumes that they would lose 14 in a row. I mean, there's a very good chance they could have gone 10-4 in that 14-game stretch, which is still pretty good. And then in the 22-game stretch, you know, who's to say they don't go 17-5? That's
The point. Some people were complaining because the opponents were too easy, which they weren't. They were at the end, but not at the beginning. They played Boston, was the first team they beat, and then they swept New York in four games.
And
those are good teams that they beat. And they beat Minnesota in it, too. And Minnesota is a playoff contender, at least. But what they didn't – like, you have to take into account, if they had lost to the White Sox or the Tigers, everyone would talk about how awful it is that they lost. Like, not just, oh, it's just another loss like anybody. No, you're terrible because you lost to this worst team ever. Well, if you're going to take it that way, then you have to take the corollary as well. So you have to win. Like, they're expected to win, and they did win. So there's nothing else they could have possibly done.
Right. What I don't understand people expected. Like, you know, the winning streak doesn't count because they play bad teams. I mean, how many bad teams do the Giants play in theirs? Like, I'm sure the Giants,
you know what's funny?
They play 26 games in a row at home, number one.
Yeah, but the Giants, I looked at theirs. Theirs was also in September, at least partially in September. And the A's a few years ago was in September. And I think that may have something to do with it as well, that you do have those teams that have kind of given up on the season, but easier to roll over on a few of those opponents.
I think we talked about it last week. We might have, where we said there's no way this winning streak happens for the Indians unless it's September because of how they were able to manipulate the roster.
Well, yeah, that's what happened last year. They got caught into a situation where they ended up having to cut Jabba Chamberlain.
If and they didn't remember. Want to do that, right?
Yeah, they cut Jabba Chamberlain because they needed another starting pitcher for the next day. They burned Trevor Bauer. Whereas on this case, if there had been a game where they went 14 or 15 innings, they could have used Ryan Merritt or Sean Morimondo. And I think they would have. I think because using Bauer in a late inning relief role is not going to happen again for the rest of the year. Like, I feel like Francona is primarily focused on winning the playoffs. He's not focused on winning any more games this year. He'll try to. Well, like, he'll
put out a lot of advantage.
Yeah, they do, but the fact that they had Jose Ramirez out for two games when Ramirez was obviously ready to play today, you know, that kind of tells you something. And every one of these injuries, these little tiny injuries that they've held guys out, Jay Bruce was out for like 4 days.
With a neck, yeah.
It definitely seemed like he probably could have played through that. And I think this is them being super, super cautious and making sure that nobody gets in. You know,
hope that
takes
the case
a little injury and making it worse.
Yeah, you hope that's the case because yesterday I was guilty of this. You know, they had that conversation with Francona before the game, the media did. And the original plan was Miller was going to pitch today. And they said, well, they've changed that. And we'll talk about after the game. Well, they didn't say it was for him to pitch on Saturday instead of Sunday. So everybody, and myself included, took that as, you know, okay, that means Miller's knee must not have responded well, and they don't want to pitch him in the next, you know, his next appearance. They want to see where to go. So I'm not sure what that says about his knee. And they only used him for two pitches, which is fine, but they got him into a situation where he had to come in with runners on, which I think is what they were trying to find a spot for him to do, even though his coming, they ran him out this first outing, and he threw like what 11 pitches and had almost a 1-2-3 inning. I think he got a little bloop single, but you know, because against the Royals, not that they do, but I would assume they're being super cautious to everybody because when they said that, you know, Guyer is not playing for 5 days, Chisenhall's not playing for 5 days because of the calf again.
Well, I think they said Chisenhall's not even going to go on the road trip, too.
Guyer's definitely not. I don't think they said that about Chisenhall, did they? I know. I know that.
That's what I heard, and I'm just making shit up anyway. I know that Ramirez is supposed to be back for the first game.
Yeah, well, I mean, that works out well for Ramirez, because if his hamstring is has any sort of soreness, you give him off Saturday, Sunday, and then they're off Monday, so that's 3 days off, especially before heading west. He didn't look like it was bothering him too much when they were spraying champagne all over each other. Then again, neither did Chisenhall, so I guess you never know. And then
yeah,
Brantley looked like he was moving fine, but I still don't think that's going to...
Honestly, that's what bothers me most about Brantley, but I think you can just say he's done. I wish they would say that. And I'll say this because I've seen Mike fucking bragging on Twitter about how right he is all the time, right? About how he said he was going to be out for the year. Or he said he was going to be out for 2 months when it originally happened. Then he came back in like 2 weeks and played amazingly for a month and then was out again. Sprained ankle, he'd be fine.
Well, I mean,
it's obviously something much more serious than that.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I guess I don't. I'm not an expert on sprained ankles. I mean, I've had plenty myself, but that's hard to say that. I don't know. Basketball players have missed a lot of time with sprained ankles. How long has he been out though? He's been out since what? Early August? Because they got Jay Bruce
for that really long road trip. Same one. But if you're talking about it being the same one, then you're talking about a sprained ankle that has lasted since like May.
Yeah.
Because that was when he originally went down. I have it on my game by game spreadsheet. I don't have it here.
Yeah.
But
it's been a while.
It was really early in the season that he initially went down on it, and that's when Mike came out and said that he was going to miss 2 months, and I was like, no, it's a sprained ankle. He's going to miss 2 weeks, and then he missed 2 weeks and came back. And like I said, he played incredibly. He it wasn't like Kipnis, where Kipnis has kind of struggled. He really killed it when he was on the team.
Yeah, he looked like, I mean, he wasn't as good as he was in 2015, but he looked like an above-average player, like he has been his entire career.
The funny
he's not
thing,
been great, he did that. He's been above average.
He did that last year too when he came back for 10 games.
He looked okay.
He was great. Now I think he stole multiple bases and he hit like six doubles or something in 10 games. He really, really crushed it last year. So it's just kind of surprising.
Yeah, I mean the ankle. I mean maybe it's more than an ankle. I don't know. I mean maybe it should be telling it's more than an ankle because they traded for Jay Bruce the same day
that he got
hurt.
But they could fit Bruce in the lineup even if Chisenhall and Brantley were healthy. I think it's because he was hurt that they were like, well, what if one of these guys isn't healthy? Then we'll need somebody else. But I think they still could have used him even if they were all healthy. They just wouldn't use Almonte or, you know, Guyer maybe.
Well, that was everybody's.
They'd find a way.
That was everybody's question: was if Chisenhall and Brantley both came back healthy, that they'd probably shove Chisenhall back to center briefly and
let them at least against right-handers.
Right. Yeah. And now that's not. I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, we won't be five innings into this whole Jason Kipnis thing. He obviously didn't get a ball hit his way today, but
I'm trying to think. I have my opinions on Kipnis and center. And did we talk about this at all last week?
I don't think so. I was wondering about that because I
don't recall.
I don't think Kipnis ever spent any time.
I think it may have came out after that. What?
It did.
Kipnis
didn't spend any time in Arizona. I think he went right to Mahoning Valley, didn't he?
You mean years ago?
Yeah, when he was drafted. I think he went right to Mahoning Valley.
It would have been before I was. Well, we weren't even in Arizona when he was drafted. Florida.
Still in Florida?
Yeah, 2009 was the first year here.
I think he was drafted in 2009, wasn't he?
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Now you're going to make me look up more things?
Yeah.
I moved here in 2010, and I only watched a couple games that year at the ACL, so I didn't Oh, he was drafted in 2008.
Okay. And he played, I don't know, he played a few innings.
No, he signed it. He was drafted by the Padres in 2008. He signed with the Indians in 2009. In Mahoning Valley. In his second season, he was in Akron.
Holy crap. So
in his third season, he was in Cleveland.
I knew he skipped Lake County. Did he also skip Carolina?
No, he played 54 games in Kinston.
Kinston, right, wow.
But then he played 79 in Akron in his second season.
Yeah, he moved quick.
So he flew up the line. He played 7 games in center field in Mahoning Valley and 18 in left field.
Right.
And that was all he played in the outfield since. So he never played second base in Mahoning Valley at all. And then he learned a brand new position in his second season, jumping up multiple levels. That's really impressive. I didn't realize that.
That is. So that makes you think maybe he can at least be passable as a center fielder for 6 innings.
Well, first thing, we know how fast everybody is now, and I guess you could look that one up if you want on Baseball Savant, how fast Jason Kipnis is.
And it's not fast.
He's never looked fast. He's a very smart base runner, kind of like Carlos Santana. Carlos Santana's not fast, but he'll steal you 3 or 4 bases in a season and usually not get caught. And he'll take an extra base every single time. I swear, every year, he's like number three or number four on the extra base list when I tally up the extra bases at the end of the year, where he's always moving. And it could be because he's on base more than everyone else, you know, so he has more chances. But he does take them. Like Edwin Encarnacion is also on base. Yeah, Encarnacion's on base. Napoli last year had some of the worst base running stats I've ever seen. He always was trying to take an extra base and always got caught.
Yeah, and everybody praised him last year. Oh, he's a smart base runner. He's always aggressive. He's always trying to take the extra base.
Yeah, well, I like aggressive base running too, but you have to be smart about it. And Kipnis is smart about it, and that's I'm trying to think. I do the top 10 updates at the end of every season where I update the top 10 stats, anything that has changed. And I know last year Kipnis and Brantley both got in the – or maybe the year before even – got into the top 10 stolen base percentage, as the best stolen base percentage. And it's like Robbie Alomar and then those two guys.
Pretty smart runners, yeah.
So they're very good at what they do. But he's not fast.
Well,
it's that they both pick their spots.
He's still above league average for speed. He's not below the threshold on – what they consider league average based on that metric.
But league average includes DHs and right fielders and first basemen and catchers. Where is he compared to center fielders?
I'll look that up right now while we talk.
Yeah, so like...
I'm still convinced he can find... I mean, like you just said, he learned a brand new position in 1 year... and you move up 2 levels. That's really impressive. I don't think there's any other way you can.
It is. It's really crazy, but it's not the same for one thing. The problem is he's moving from an easier position, right? Second base is considered one of the easiest positions, I believe.
No, that's still a tough position. I mean, a lot of guys, if you look at, I don't think you read Brian Kenny's book, Head of the Curve.
No,
most the defensive spectrum is usually when guys like obviously first base is the lowest. I mean besides DH, but first base is the lowest end of the defensive spectrum. But usually, guys move from the infield to the outfield. Not center field, but they move to the infield to the outfield.
I remember seeing the list, like the actual list, and it was like shortstop, catcher, center field, third base. And then maybe second base.
Okay,
it's in that bottom half of.
Yeah.
You know, as far as how easy it is, and to put him in center field, which is really should be your second best defender. You know, like shortstop should be your best defender. Well, center field should be your second
that's
best.
That's always the case. Yeah. So Jason Kipnis is at.
So I.
27.2 on sprint speed, which is.
Meters 0.2. Per second? What are we talking here?
Huh? Feet per second.
Is it meters per second?
No, it's feet per second. So that's 0.2 feet per second above the league threshold. Four center fielders. For the league. Yeah, he's barely above. I mean, there is only a handful. Adam Jones is below him. Tyler Naquin's below him, which is sad, actually.
Well, if Naquin's below him, then, I mean, that just answered that question, I guess.
Yeah, Jackie Bradley is barely above him. And Jackie Bradley's considered, by the way, a great defender, obviously.
Well, and obviously it isn't all about speed.
No, Greg Allen, by the way, 27.4. That's actually kind of
slow.
Disappointing. Yeah, I mean, Zimmer's 29.9, which, you know, when you're saying 27.4 to 29.9, that's barely 2.2 seconds, 2 seconds, but that 2 seconds makes a, you know, a big difference. But so I'm a little surprised Greg Allen's much lower on that list.
It may be a sample size thing too, that they get more accurate as they get more data.
I'm trying to, I'm going to go back and look too. I want to see where Austin Jackson is, because there's another, you know, component into it. So Austin Jackson,
yeah, I will say,
27.5. Yeah. So Jason Kipnis is aside from Almonte, which Almonte is probably the only guy that should be playing center field that's not named Jason Kipnis, because Greg Allen's faster and he's a better defender, but the rest of the guys in the team, I mean, I'm not putting Brandon Guyer in center. Austin Jackson, I wouldn't put in center, even though they do it.
You know, well, okay, so watching as much baseball as I do, I've seen plenty of guys, especially the last 2 years, they really focused on the Indians drafting these speedy guys.
Mm-hmm.
The last few years. So last year we had Trenton Brooks. This year we had Quinton Holmes. Year before, and Connor Capel last year. And the year before we had Gabriel Mejia. And all these guys are really fast. And all of them made stupid mistakes playing defense in center field. And sometimes, like Holmes especially, you'd see him mess up, and then he had time to turn around and fix it because he was so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And Gabriel Mejia, I've seen do that as well, where I'd root to a ball, and then he'll fix it you know, like halfway through, like, oh, okay, I got this. Whereas someone like, I still don't know how to pronounce his first name, but Kai Tom, I guess mm-hmm. I call him Blaze Tom, he may be a better instinctual outfielder than those other guys, even though he's a short, fat guy.
Well, I mean, look at Abe Almonte. No one looks at me. Abe Almonte.
Yeah, Almonte is too, and he's not that fast, but he's better. So, but that's on instinct. So you need two things. You can be the fast guy who can mess up and fix it, like Bradley Zimmer, like Greg Allen, and the guys I mentioned, or you could be the great instincts. Where you know exactly where to go, which I think Chisenhall's pretty good at, in right field at least. Honestly, I think Brantley's pretty decent at least in left field, when he has played. But those things are learned. You don't just get that overnight. So Kipnis doesn't have the speed, and he doesn't have the instincts, which is not instincts like evolutionary instincts. It's more repeated behavior instincts, right. You know, like that you get.
Repetition, yeah.
But he hasn't done that. So he doesn't have either of those two things. So I've kind of got a running list in my head of things I'd rather see than Jason Kipnis in center field, and I'm not sure. I thought about putting it on Twitter. I may put it in an article at some point. But I'm not.
I don't know. I think he does have the experience in college, and he does have the experience in a little bit in Mahoning Valley. Obviously, that's nowhere near the experience at the MLB level, because
I'll say this: experience with an AZL team is better than experience with college or Mahoning Valley, because they play on a major league field. The fences have to be 20 feet further out at Goodyear Ballpark than they are at most of those other fields. And when you're playing center, that's a real center field. It's tough. There's triples all over the place. Well, you really got to be. Know what you're doing.
I think the only thing that you see the difference in is reading the ball off a bat in the major leagues is so much different than the minors, because you know, you've got better pitchers who can spin the ball better. You've got hitters who know how to create backspin and, you know, hit the, you know, can hit certain pitches better. Whereas you're more likely to get a lazy can of corn in the minor leagues with guys who can't put the barrel on the ball and for pitchers who have below average spin rates on pitches. So that changes how you're going to be able to read the ball off the bat, because that's the first thing you do is you got to get a good read on it. Yeah. I don't know how great his route running is going to be, because if he's not used to reading the way the ball is going to spin, that's why I laugh at people who think like, who don't understand how complex playing defense in baseball is, especially in the outfield, is because it's not as easy as we'll just go out there and shag flies, because
yeah,
you know, a Corey Kluber curveball, and for a guy to hit that into center field, it's going to react differently than how it would be if, you know, Sean Armstrong throws a fastball. The ball is not, you're not going to read the ball the same.
And I will say,
different elite skills.
On that, if somebody does want to understand how that works, the best book I've read on that specific topic is a book called Men at Work, I believe. By George Will. And in particular, the chapter, there's three sections. There's one on pitching, which is Oral Hershiser, which is kind of cool. There's one on what I'm talking about is the one by Cal Ripken, or where he interviews Cal Ripken. And the way Cal Ripken knew, like, what pitch was going to throw, he would shift. But he wouldn't shift early, because then the hitter would know where he was going to shift. So he would start shifting as the pitch was thrown, and then hitters started catching on to this type of pitch it would be by the way he was shifting. So he would, like, shift the wrong direction as the pitch was thrown, and then go the right way. And it was just all this cat and mouse game and stuff, and it's really in-depth, and that's – and, of course, shortstop is –
the hardest position.
Yeah. By far the most difficult position on the baseball field to play. I guess, catcher is probably the most painful, but
it's difficult.
Having the physical abilities, you know, you see a lot of fat catchers. You don't see a whole lot of fat shortstops.
Yeah, I mean,
except Johnny Peralta.
Johnny Peralta, I mean,
he was a.
I really think that's an Eric Wedge philosophy. It was is a misused one. Is he said that Peralta made all the routine plays, and that's what you want.
Well, that's what Jason Kipnis does.
Right, and I wonder
honestly at second base. And I would say this as far as like about the things I'd rather see than Kipnis in center. I would rather see Kipnis go back to second base. And then it depends on who you want in the lineup. Let's say you want Yandy Diaz in there, and for whatever reason you don't want Yandy Diaz in the outfield, put Jose Ramirez back in the outfield. He played it last year. It took him a little while to figure it out, but once he did, he was fine.
He was not good. That's such a misconception. We all thought he was.
He was bad at the beginning, but he got better.
If you look at
put him at third.
A lot of them say he was not great.
Okay, so put Jose at third and put Yandy in the outfield where he's been playing the last 2 years.
They saw an experiment so fast.
Yeah, there's a lot of different things you could do. And if you do that, then you're talking about putting Chisenhall in center maybe or Jackson in center. Both of those are preferable to Kipnis in center. No, Jackson, you know, and Chisenhall.
They may do somehow with Tyler Naquin in center, pretty much in a platoon with Rajai Davis in center field last year. Mm-hmm. I think the question is obviously number one: is Kipnis's bat going to give you enough value? Not the rest of the season, because who cares what he does the rest of the season? You need him enough reps to be who he was. To get to the postseason, you need Jason Kipnis to be Jason Kipnis in the postseason. And if he needs 45, 50 at bats the rest of the season to get there, who cares if he gets 200 the rest of the way? You just need him to feel like he's got enough reps. But
well, yeah, but who is more valuable, him or Yandy Diaz?
Right. So is his bat in center field? Is his bat going to make up for what he might cost you in center field so much so that it's worth putting him out there? And does Yandy Diaz's bat produce enough to also kind of make up for that as well. Like, and plus the only way they can do it, I think that says they want Diaz's, they want Diaz on the roster. I don't think they'd be trying this if they didn't want.
Well, no, they've said that in
Diaz on the roster.
Francona said essentially that when somebody plays the way that Diaz has played lately, you can't take him out of the roster. And that was in that whole Kipnis piece where Kipnis said he would sit on the bench if he has to, and he'll play whatever position they need him to play.
Which, by the way, I don't think you can give him enough credit for.
No, that is great, and I think that's something that this whole team has done, at least. It's funny, I guess when Cody Allen comes out earlier in the year and says, hey, you can give my saves to Andrew Miller if you need him to only pitch one inning at a time. As soon as your closer says that, and then more recently he said that if Brian Shaw was on the team first, that Brian Shaw would be the closer and Allen would be set up, which I don't think is true. But
that might be true.
But he said that, and when your closer, the guy who is supposed to be Kenny Powers, the guy who's supposed to be the psychopath, he's that humble, at least outwardly. It makes it very difficult for anybody on the team to come out and say, no, I am doing this. Like, I remember Grady Sizemore, they wanted to bat him third because he was the best hitter on the team. So they said, we want to bet you third. He said, no, I'm only going to hit leadoff. And it was like, you're an asshole. They're trying to make the team better, and you're saying, no, I'm only going to bat leadoff. Who cares about you? Bat third because they need you to bat third. Like, do it. And so when Carlos Santana's went back and forth sometimes, but recently he's been so agreeable to anything that they've asked him to do.
Well,
played right field, he said first, he said third, fourth, fifth, whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, Santana had to, like you said, grow into that because he got mad when he lost the first base job to
Cliff Johnson.
Cliff Johnson, yeah.
Chris Johnson.
Yeah, and Tito said he's got to work harder playing first base. But, I mean, even before that, when they signed, this tells you how
stupid. Well, they moved him from catcher to third, and, you know, like, because they wanted to make him a DH, and he didn't want to play DH. And you know what? He fucking worked at it, and now he's the best first baseman in baseball. So,
yeah.
Ecology works.
Right. It did work because he was frustrated. Years. He was frustrated by losing his catching time to Yan Gomes. And then he was frustrated that he lost first base. So, but before that, he offered to play third because he didn't want a DH. That didn't work out, you know, but he worked at it and he was, you know, gave it a shot. And then, you know, the first base thing worked out, but he's also done the outfield now and he's even agreed to hit leadoff. And I know, like, it's easier to say, yeah, I'll hit anywhere, whatever. But I mean, it's good that Santana never changed his approach to hit leadoff. He was actually better at it.
Well, it's interesting. Like, Lindor recently said something about how he didn't like hitting anything but leadoff, but he never said anything at the time. He waited until after they put him back into the leadoff spot to say, yeah, I didn't really like hitting down there. I like hitting leadoff. I'd prefer to be up there where I can steal bases and do whatever.
It's the same thing.
And so I like that, but they don't complain about it publicly. You see it from other teams a lot where they'll come out and complain about things publicly, and maybe it helps when you just went to the World Series and you've got the guy who's considered the best manager in baseball, and he's won two since he's been on the team. And you've got a core that's signed through 2020 for the most part, so you really shouldn't be starting shit.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of Shaw and Santana, I guess they could. But they have it on the line because if they did something this year where they're like, oh, that guy's a bad teammate, that could cost them $5 million. You know, you know, like that could really hurt them. So you want to be the best defensive first baseman and the greatest teammate and top 15 hitters in baseball. Like, you want to be all those things, not just one of them or two of them. And same with Shaw.
And you want the team that you play for when you're going into free agency to put you in the best position possible to cash in.
Yeah, like the opposite of what Lucroy did.
Whoops. Well, that's why, like, it's one thing for
players. Well, I mean, he came off as a jerk, and now he's in Colorado.
And now he's not going to cash in next year because he's played like shit.
Yeah.
He stays in Colorado, which, you know, is hitter friendly. I mean, like, it's one thing for Jason Kipnis to say, you know, I'll sit here and ride these rookies' coattails if I have to. I'll play the bench because, and this is nothing against him, he's already got his money. He's got a $72 million contract. He's set. Cody Allen, and because he's a pitcher, it's even harder. because he can blow his arm out, and that could be it. You know, knock on wood, that doesn't happen because I'm so tired of injuries with this team. Arbitration is so ass backwards for relievers that anybody who doesn't get a save doesn't get paid. Like, if you're a middle reliever who has a 1.80 ERA,
it costs himself some money. Definitely.
Right, right. It's going to cost him money in the long run because if they got Miller and Miller, you know, soaked up some of his saves, you know, that was going to cost him, you know, X amount of dollars. And he said, screw it, I don't care. Let's win.
Like, this year, he's only got, like, 27, I think. And I don't know exactly where it is, but usually you have a lot of guys have, like, around 40 saves in a season.
For 91 teams, yeah.
Yeah, so an arbiter could look at that and say, well, you're not an elite closer because you only had 27 saves and these guys had 40, which is stupid. It's just like the 20-win season threshold, which I don't believe any pitchers are going to get to 20 wins this year.
No, I know there's not.
Because, wait, Kluber has two more starts left, and he's at 17. So
and Sale, same thing.
Yeah, so I think they're all about that. And he's leading the league at 17. So nobody – the only way is if somebody – no, I don't think there's any way.
Nope.
Somebody up and make him pitch three games, three of the last 12 games.
So the original question, though, like, okay, Tyler Naquin, I don't know if you saw the new StatCast stat they rolled out, which was outs above average
last week. No, I saw a couple people talking about it, but I haven't looked through it.
Yeah, so it's only for outfielders, which I find interesting. Last year, Tyler Naquin, out of 208 qualified outfielders, was 201st with negative 11 outs above average. By the same metric, which is really interesting to me because he didn't play the full year last year for suspension, Abraham Almonte was the – Brandon Guyer was much better, actually. He was a part-timer. Guyer had 4 outs above average last year, and Almonte had 2. And Almonte is at positive 2 this year, outs above average. And he is the Indians' leader there. Brantley also has 2 outs above average, too, but I think – a lot of tribute to that. It's his, I guess maybe not. I guess it is just catches. It's not anything to do with throwing. I figured maybe his outfield assist played into that. But no, he's got 2 outs above average, too. So by this measure, Abraham Almonte is the Indians' best defensive outfielder, even better than Bradley Zimmer, who's at an even 0.
Yeah, I'm not going to jump. If
that's true, but.
Jump on a brand new stat that just came out yesterday.
No, I'm not either. I'm just trying to.
I'll say, looking at it right now, here. 3 of the top 5 guys. 100% makes sense. Obvious. It's Byron Buxton is number 1, and then Lorenzo Cain is 4, and Kevin Kiermaier is 5. Those are three of the.
Yeah.
The 3 of the best outfielders in baseball. Ender Inciarte, I have not seen play enough recently. I saw him play when he was with Arizona. I don't recall him being that good to be second in baseball, but I guess it's possible. And then Mookie Betts is 3rd. And again, I don't really remember Mookie Betts being.
Historically, I mean, if you look at like Fangraphs stuff, I mean, it backs up in Ciarte that he's been that good.
Okay. And Billy Hamilton is 11, which seems like he should be higher because he makes crazy catches that don't make any sense.
Right.
Jerod Dyson is 16. Another guy that really. Okay, but Adam Duvall is 13th. There's no way Adam Duvall is that good.
Well, I think Park Backer's playing to that, too. Look how small the outfield is in Cincinnati.
Yeah,
it's easier to play the outfield there. But, I mean, if you look at the Indians don't have anybody in the top 30 in defensive runs saved or ultimate zone rating for 150 innings. They don't have anybody in the top 30. If these all match up, then, I mean, how many – actually, I lied about that. They do have someone in the top 30. I guarantee you'll never guess who that foreign person in the top 30 is.
Isn't it? You're talking about just outfielders?
Just outfielders.
Brandon Guyer.
No, it's Jay Bruce.
Oh,
Jay Bruce has 8 defensive run saves, and he's 19th in UZR.
Hear that? When 4.9. They got him. They said, yeah, his numbers are finally better.
Yeah. But I mean, if these all match up, then the Indians' outfield's not that great. And
no, we knew that. It hasn't been that great all year. Gavin did something on it like in April about how shitty it was. I mean,
Right. If you're going to put Jason Kipnis out there, how much worse are you making it? But at the same time,
you can go negative.
You can, sure. I mean, here's another question too. You don't think that what happened last year is going to happen again, but can he avoid what happened to Tyler Naquin in game 6? Like, is Jason Kipnis that bad? Would he be?
Well, it's weird because that was a rookie mistake. I think you chalk it up as he didn't take charge of a play he should have taken charge of.
But that thing, same thing could happen to Kipnis.
Combined with the fact that he doesn't have the range or whatever, playing 20 games, you know, he's got 12 games. Well, I don't. That's not that long. I guess I was thinking there's more time. I wouldn't be putting him in the outfield in the playoffs. It just there's not enough time to get him used to it. I think this could maybe be a thing for the future. Like next year, let's say Brantley's injury is really serious and for whatever reason he can't come back and they don't use his option, then maybe move Kipnis to left field or something. Maybe that's like where they're kind of going with this. I can't see him playing postseason in the World Series. He put Santana in right field in the World Series, but
yeah,
and that's hard to think about doing something like that.
Okay,
when you have Greg Allen, you know you have him, and you can just they've scored so much recently, and that's kind of we talk about the pitchers a lot. Kind of been focusing on them, especially on the website and on Twitter, been focusing on how great the pitchers were during the streak, and they were fantastic. But they were scoring a ton of runs, too. They had a 105 run differential in 22 games. You need to score those runs to have that. You not only need to hold the other team from scoring, but you have to score 105 more runs than the other team scored. So they are scoring plenty of runs right now.
Okay, but again, those runs came against inferior teams. They came against Detroit and the White Sox, who don't have good pitching, and the Orioles, even though they didn't score a lot of runs against the Orioles, but...
But they've also killed Chris Sale, and they beat the Yankees 4 straight, and they've got a decent pitching staff. I saw recently that they have the best pitching staff in baseball. So
yeah, that was a great article.
That was interesting. There was an earthquake in Los Angeles, is no longer in baseball. They're gone, wonder. And the Indians got sucked up in a waterspout.
Well, not yet. They're not in L.A. yet, so hopefully not.
No, in Lake Erie.
Oh, in Lake Erie. Oh, fantastic. Who knew? I was just out.
Missed the Browns. I don't know how.
I'm glad I escaped that because I was at the game today. I'm glad I got out in time. I mean, ultimately, this obviously comes down to just getting this hit enough to make it worth it playing center field. That's really what it comes down to. And realistically, you're not going to play Jason Kipnis in center field 9 innings in a playoff game. You're going to try to go through 3 at bats with him and play defense and hope he doesn't, you know, hurt you too bad out there. And you're going to put somebody else in center field. That sets up for Greg Allen making it because unless you're going to put Almonte in the last spot,
I almost guarantee Greg Allen makes it.
I don't agree. I'd like that to happen, but I don't think it's going to happen.
You have to have someone who can play defense and run. Now, I think they can take 6. They're only going to take 4 starters. I don't think that they put the 5th starter in the bullpen.
No.
As of right now.
Well,
so I don't think they put Tomlin.
Because right now Salazar is in the bullpen. So no. He counts as a bullpen.
No, guy. Salazar will be. I think he will be in the playoff bullpen. I'm talking about Clevinger and Tomlin. One of those guys is not going to make the starting rotation for the postseason. I think the other guy is going to be left off the roster entirely. Spot sure. That you don't have right now. I don't think they need more than 7 relievers.
Yeah, you saw the report last week. They're talking about carrying 14 position players.
An extra position player, so it's Greg Allen. I mean, that's just even if he's, well, if he's and not a starter or whatever.
It's not going to be Gonzalez, I think, because they keep putting Urshela at second to make sure he can handle it, and I think he can.
Urshela will make the team. Mejia is not going to make the team. They don't need 3 catchers.
Obviously.
But that's who your guys are. Like they don't have that many position players with the team right now. It's not like they didn't expand the position players nearly as much as they did the pitching staff.
Right. So I think the last spot comes down to Almonte or Allen. Well, and
both make the team because I don't think Brantley's there, and I don't think Chisenhall.
Well, Chisenhall and Guyer both might not be there now. You know, Guyer shut down.
Well, I definitely think there's a great chance that Guyer's not there, even if he's good, even if he's healthy. I would take Allen or Almonte over Guyer at this point. He's just
hitting. If they play, if they win the wild, okay, let's say they hold on to the top spot, which they have a game and a half lead, which is essentially a 2.5 game lead because the Astros have to be a game better than the Indians to break the tie because the Indians own the tiebreaker. So they essentially have a 2.5 game lead in the wild, in the best record race. So let's assume they hold on to that. Then you play the winner of New York, Minnesota, or L.A., and you make the roster based on who wins that game because the roster doesn't have to be in until the day before the game. So I don't think – I mean, obviously anything can happen, but I don't
think – Well, you want to talk about bad pitching. Look at the Angels. I mean, they get to play them this week, so it'll be interesting to see, but they have a terrible pitching staff.
Right, and they're going to miss Greg
Garrett. Minnesota's terrible too. Yeah. So the only one that has a decent pitching staff of those three teams is going to be New York. And I would have to guess New York wins that game.
Sure, because they're going to throw Luis Severino.
You never know. It's a crapshoot.
It is. It's a one game. You never know.
Yeah, it gets them out of the way.
Right. So, but the Yankees don't have, other than Aroldis Chapman.
Is Sabathia?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. I don't think he's going to start a playoff game. Maybe. I don't have a bunch of left-handers. So why would you use Guyer? Because are you really going to start Guyer against, I mean, I would guess that their rotation is going to be, if they burn Severino in the wild card game, you've got Gray in game one of the ALDS, or Tanaka, one of those two, and then the third game is Severino, and then game four, you can go back to Tanaka or Sonny Gray. None of those guys are left-handed. And Chapman is the only left-hander in that bullpen, I think, other than that they trust.
If you want to, we've talked about this a few times now with the defense slash offense platoon rather than a right-left platoon. So you had it with like a Jackson and Zimmer, and then you had it with Diaz and Ursula, and now maybe you have it with Kipnis too. If you want to go with the defensive route, start Ursula, leave Diaz on the bench, and there's your right-handed pinch hitter if you need one.
They'll still go the other way.
They probably will. Pinch hit. The problem is you don't want to pinch hit Ursula even for Perez or Gomes.
No, you don't. I mean, I don't know who your pinch hitter is. I guess whichever outfielder is healthiest. Like Jay Bruce is going to start.
Greg Allen wouldn't really be the option either.
You have to hope Chisenhall, I guess, is healthy. Because otherwise your pinch hitter is what? Almonte maybe? Like, let's say, what if Chisenhall and
Guyer make it? It's been like that all
year.
Man, it's been like that all year, though.
Yeah. So you got to hope it's Chisenhall, all right. I guess. But
yeah, we'll see if he's back. I there's a better chance of him coming back, I think, than Guyer. I think Guyer.
Or Brantley, even, obviously.
Might be done. Well, I've already completely given up on Brantley.
I agree. I hope Chisenhall comes back, because that really makes things – you're right, that makes the bench – that might open a spot for Eric Gonzalez then, if Chisenhall doesn't come back.
I don't see a purpose of Eric Gonzalez being on this team. Anyway.
He's faster than Urshela.
Who cares?
But I agree with you because I agree with you because if they start Urshela and go to Diaz as the pinch hitter, the odds of you have to look at the odds of the guys fail 7 out of 10 times and they're Hall of Famers by hitting 300, which batting average is stupid, but you're gonna fail 7 out of 10 times. Whereas think of how many balls Mike hit at the third base in any given game.
And it's funny because you brought it up today with Kipnis, which is he played the first four innings? Five innings. He played the first five innings, didn't get a ball, then they pull him in and the next two get hit out to Greg Allen or two of the next three do.
Right.
It's like if you can predict when the balls are going to get hit to the position, like you can predict when the guy's going to come up in the order. Like you know that the Indians catcher is going to come up in the 6th, 7th, 8th, or 9th inning at some point when it might matter. And you can pinch hit for him. Like you know that going into the game. So if you have someone on the bench that you want to put in for that guy, you're like, okay, I can do that. And I know, once we get to the 6th, if something important starts happening, that's when I'm going to pull my defensive guy out and put in my hitter. But You can't do it the other way. You can't say, oh, in the sixth inning, something really important is going to happen at third base, so we better have our guy over there.
Well, I guess you can kind of predict that, you know, which guys are likely to hit it where. Like, if you look at the Yankees lineup, and I don't know, this is obviously I'm just making up numbers, but if you predict that the Yankees as a team, if you look at their hitters, they hit the ball to center field, you know, 60% of the time or 50% of the time, whatever.
Yeah, I guess you can do that.
See, you can look at that, you know, does Kipnis stand to Costas big time playing center field today? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, he had, like, today was a great day because Corey Kluber's pitching. Corey Kluber does not allow a lot of hits up the middle. Like, if you look at the numbers.
Well, he also strikes out 12, 13 guys per nine.
Right. So
he doesn't allow a whole lot of hits at all.
But if you have, I mean, I guess this is a really bad point because the Indians are, like we talked about at the start of the episode, this is a great way to finish, or a great way to connect the dots, I guess, is that the Indians strike out a lot of batters as a team. The only guy that you probably, because Carrasco strikes a lot of guys out, Bauer is striking more guys out this year, although he's more likely to give up a hit to center field. But, like, the only guy that you would worry about is Josh Tomlin, because Josh Tomlin's the only starter that doesn't strike a lot of guys out. So you could realistically say that the Indians pitchers as a whole strike out enough batters where they can minimize Kipnis's risk in center field.
Yeah, I've definitely made that argument before.
Yeah, I know you have.
All right, so did you forget my Pope joke?
No.
I didn't tell it. Did you forget? You didn't forget that I was going to tell a Pope joke?
I didn't forget it. I mean, you see, you made a Pope joke last week.
No, I didn't. Did I?
You didn't.
Did I tell the Pope joke last week?
I think you did. Well, tell it again.
No, I just said it. I said at the end of the episode, I have a joke about the Pope.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. I thought you had one last year. Oh, you know what? You said you were going to, and you didn't. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so I was going to say it this week, so I got it. That's what I put on the episode. All right. Okay, so the Pope is going to Boston, and this limo driver has been asked to drive the Pope mobile.
The Pope mobile.
Yeah. So the limo driver. What? No, you've never seen the Pope mobile?
I've not.
It's got like a glass box in the back or whatever. So the limo driver. The thing is, like, he liked to fuck with Yankee fans. So he'd, like, speed up and, like, almost hit the Yankee fans, right, when he was driving. But he knew he was driving the Pope, and he's like, I can't do this. I got to be on my best behavior. I got to be perfect. So he's driving down the street, and he sees a Yankees fan, and he, like, thinking, like, oh, I want to – no, I can't. I can't. I'm with the Pope. I got to behave. And then he drives by him, and then he hears thud. And he looks back. He's like, what was that? And the Pope goes, don't worry. I got him with the door.
Wow.
I love that joke.
That actually is pretty good. I will give you credit. That's a pretty good joke. I think I've heard that
was another
in different context.
I have another really good Yankee joke I just remembered.
Oh, okay. I guess finish
it. I'll save it. Remind me next week. Remind me next week. I have a really good Yankees rape joke.
Oh, this is going to be awkward. Okay.
Everyone loves those.
So next week is our last regular season episode, isn't it? Next Sunday?
I thought you were going to say it's our last episode ever because...
It might be. No, it won't be. There's another Sunday. I forgot. They end on October 1st, not next Sunday.
Yeah, so we got a couple weeks left.
Got 2 weeks of bad jokes left. Wonderful. What? 2 weeks left
for you. I have a lifetime of bad jokes left.
You guys can never follow him at Burning River BRB.
I can't tell these jokes on there because I've made a promise that my Twitter is a clean area that is safe for anybody to follow. Doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter. You can be 75. I don't care. You can follow me, and I'll never swear. I promise. I will never say negative things about somebody out of context. Never make ad hominem attacks on people. It's strictly business. I may say a player isn't very good, but I'm talking statistically and not about his moral compass or his value in life.
I've made no such promises.
So you can follow me. Yeah, Justin's Twitter is pretty shitty. It was better today. He made one good joke. So.
Oh, was that my Was that my whose line is it anyway joke for Angel Hernandez?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that, I thought that was a really good joke.
I mean, I'm sure it's been made a million times, but it's fine.
I'm sure it has. I don't claim to be original. I just claim to make the good ones and provide my own context, hopefully. Anyway, Angel Hernandez was awful again today, which is no surprise anyway.
Yeah, no, and he cost the Indians with two runs.
Yeah, he sure did. That should have had strike three on Brandon Moss. Although I assume that Brandon Moss wasn't going to get a hit regardless, because Brandon Moss versus left-handers is usually pretty awful, which this Royals team is terrible. Do you know that I have to look this up?
It's supposed to be over.
It's supposed to be over. Now I got to look at it, because I'm pretty sure Brandon Moss makes more money than Corey Kluber. Or Brandon Moss makes
$3 an hour.
Okay, he's guaranteed. Oh, he's only making 3.75 this year, and then 7.25 next year. So he'll make more money next year than Jose Ramirez. But for now, he is making more money than Jose Ramirez, only because Ramirez's contract does not kick into 2018. So next year he'll still make more than Jose Ramirez, and next year he'll still make. This year he still makes more than him, and next year he'll make almost as much as Corey Kluber. That's pretty awesome. Go Royals. Okay. Go Royals.
Is that enough? It's enough for me.
I mean, I could talk show in the Royals all day. I don't think there's a team I hate more in baseball than the Royals right now. So I'm cool with that.
I think it's time for me to sing my song.
Oh, we should make a mention of Eric Hosmer and his – did you see his comments after the game on Friday when they had the streak?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't care. Did you see my comments on it?
I did not.
Well, it was today after he – what happened? Maybe he got a single and he was like at first and he was talking some shit or something like that. And I quoted Dr. Dre and saying the Indians can say to the Royals that they have to jump and swing up to hit him in the knees.
I did see that, yeah.
You don't know that song, though, do you?
I don't know the song. I did see your joke.
It's,
I know
It's Bodyguard by it's Eminem and Dr. Dre, and I believe they're talking shit on 50 Cent.
I'm sure it's a good.
It's a
good
fantastic song.
I'm sure
it's
is.
It's great.
They don't make bad songs, so I'm sure it is.
No, it's really good. You want my song now?
Sure. You can turn the song off. How we're ending it? Okay. All right.
It's a parody song.
Okay, I'm gonna hit the
balls go out. Runs come in. There ain't no baseball player like Tyler Naquin. That's it.
Oh, okay. Good night, everybody.